The idea of a school where a bell rang every 41 minutes, prompting you on to the next classroom with a new teacher and a new concentration of students, made me feel like I was a guest star on Saved by the Bell or something. But the most exciting part of that first morning was English. Honors English, another distinction my old school never made, in which I had secured a spot thanks to that brilliant 150-word description of my cat's tragic demise. I couldn't wait to take notes in the bright green pen I'd bought at the school store. Mount St. Teresa's made us write in pencil like babies, but Bradley didn't care what you wrote in, didn't care if you took notes at all, as long as you kept your grades up. Bradley's school colors were green and white, and I bought a pen the same shade as the basketball jerseys to display my new allegiance. Honors English was a small class, only 12 students, and instead of desks, we got to sit at 3 long tables, pushed together to form the shape of a bracket. The teacher, Mr. Larson, was someone Mom would dismiss as hefty. But those 20 extra pounds had resulted in a kind, full face. Squinty eyes, a slight arch to his upper lip that made him look like he was remembering some hilarious crack one of his buddies had made to him the night before over lukewarm Bud Lights. He wore faded pastel button-downs and had the kind of floppy, light brown hair that assured us it wasn't too long that he was a prep school kid just like us, and he, like, totally got it. My 14-year-old loins approved. All the 14-year-old loins approved. Mr. Larson sat a lot, usually with his legs stretched out in front of him, frequently reaching one hand behind his head and resting his skull against it while asking, "And why do you think Holden identifies with the catcher in the rye?" That first day, Mr. Larson made us all go around the room and say one cool thing that we'd done that summer. I felt confident Mr. Larson had designed this exercise for my benefit. Most of the other kids, lifers, had been funneled from the Bradley Middle School and had probably spent the summer hanging out together. But no one knew what the new kid had been up to. And even though it was just tanning on my back porch watching soap operas through the window like a sweaty, friendless loser, they didn't need to know that. When it was my turn, I told everyone I'd gone to the Pearl Jam concert on August 23rd, which hadn't happened but also wasn't a fabrication I'd created out of thin air. Leah's mom had reserved tickets for us back before the whole pot fiasco, before she finally had definitive proof that I was the bad influence she'd long suspected I was. But there was an ocean between Leah and these new people, and I had some new friends to impress. So I lied, and I'm glad I did. My one cool thing I did that summer invited several approving nods and even an actual cool from some guy named Tanner, which I was surprised to learn was not just a goal I set for my skin that summer, but also a name. After that game was over, Mr. Larson wanted to talk about The Catcher in the Rye, which had been assigned summer reading. I sat up straighter in my seat. I'd torn through the book in 2 days on my back porch, my thumbs leaving humid half-moon imprints on every page. Mom asked me what I thought about it, and when I told her I thought it was hilarious, she cocked her head at me and said, "Tiff, he has a serious mental breakdown." This revelation shocked me so much that I reread the book, deeply concerned that this crucial element of the story had escaped me. For a moment, I worried that I wasn't the literary whiz I fancied myself, but then I reminded myself how Mount St. Teresa's eschewed literature in favor of grammar. Less sex and sin in grammar. And so it wasn't really my fault that my observations weren't as sharp as they could be. I'd get there. The boy closest to the marker board groaned. His name was Arthur. And that summer, the coolest thing he did was take a tour of the New York Times office, which, based on the reactions of the classroom, wasn't as cool as seeing Pearl Jam in concert, but also not as bad as seeing the Phantom of the Opera at the Kimmel Center. Even I understood it's not impressive unless it's on Broadway. "You enjoyed it that much, did you?" Mr. Larson quipped, and the classroom tittered. Arthur was close to 300 pounds, and acne framed his face like parentheses. His hair was so greasy that when he pushed his hands through it, it stayed, an oily arc from his hairline to the crown of his head. Could Holden be any less self-aware? Here he is, calling everyone a phony when he's the biggest phony of them all. You bring up an interesting point, Mr. Larson said encouragingly. Is Holden a reliable narrator? The bell rang before anyone could answer, and over Mr. Larson's instructions to read the first two chapters of Into Thin Air, which we would discuss later in the week, everyone swept notebooks and pencils into their book bags before storming out in a rush of Steve Madden clogs and peach fuzz-covered legs. I didn't understand how everyone got out the door so quickly. It was the first time I noticed it, but once I did, I noticed it for the rest of my life. I was slow. What comes effortlessly to others doesn't for me. When I realized I was alone with Mr. Larson, my cheeks blushed underneath the cover girl Mom said I needed, and I assumed the other girls would be wearing. They weren't. You're joining us from St. Teresa's, am I right? Mr. Larson hunched over his desk, shuffled through some papers. Mount St. Teresa's. I finally managed to zip my book bag. Mr. Larson looked up from his desk, and the crease in his lip deepened. Right. Well, the book report you did was very good. Very thorough. Even though I would lie in bed later, replaying this moment over and over until I gritted my teeth and clenched my fists to keep from spontaneously combusting, all I wanted to do was get out of there. I've never known the right thing to say. And my face probably looked like my Irish aunt's when she has too much red wine and starts stroking my hair and telling me how much she wishes she had a daughter. Thanks. Mr. Larson smiled and his eyes disappeared.
Happy to have you in my class.
Uh-huh. See you tomorrow. I started to give a wave and changed my mind halfway through. I probably looked like I had some kind of Tourette's tick. I'd learned about Tourette's on a sick day, watching an episode of the Sally Jesse Raphael show. Mr. Larson gave me a small wave back. There was a broken desk a few steps outside of Mr. Larson's classroom, and Arthur had his book bag propped up on it. He was rummaging around in there, but looked up as I approached.
Hey, he said.
Hi.
My glasses,
he said by way of explanation. Oh. I slid my hands underneath the straps of my book bag and gripped tightly.
Do you have lunch now?
He asked. I nodded. But I'd planned on spending it in the library. I couldn't imagine anything worse than that moment after paying for my food, looking around the room at the expanse of nameless faces, and being forced to sit down where I wasn't wanted because you weren't allowed to bring food outside the cafeteria. There was so much to talk about on the first day of school. No one wanted to waste that precious gossip time by taking on the responsibility of making the new girl feel included. I got it. I would have been just as disinterested. I knew things would shift to the familiar eventually. That the curly redhead with soft blue veins in her forehead would become the girl with the highest IQ in class, who would apply early decision to Harvard and have the distinction of being the first Bradley student from the class of 2005 to be accepted. Out of a class of 71 students, there would be 9 overall. Mainline Magazine hadn't determined Bradley an exemplary college preparatory option for nothing. That the short, stocky soccer player with actual pecs would become the guy who had gotten a blowjob from Lindsay Biz Haynes in his best friend's basement last summer while his best friend watched. These faces and identities would eventually come together for me. And I would eventually become someone to everyone else, too, with anecdotal lore to explain why I sat with who I sat with, why my allegiances resided where they did. But until then, I preferred to maintain my dignity by getting a head start on my Spanish homework in the library.
I'll walk with you, Arthur offered.
He slung his lumpy backpack over one shoulder and led the way, his swollen pale calves brushing against each other as he plodded down the stairs.
I knew what it was like to have your body betray you. I was only 14, and I already looked like a college student who needed to lose the freshman 15.
Teenage boys were stupid, though,
and because I had relatively skinny arms and legs and a chest that looked pornographic in V-neck tees, they thought I had the perfect body. This, despite the fact that underneath the clothes was a genetic mess that not even a prom dress-induced bout of anorexia could fix. A stomach that was rippled with fat. A belly button that winked like an Asian eye. It was the summer the tankini came into style, and never had I been more grateful for a piece of clothing in my life.
"Are you, like, in love with Mr. Larson like every other girl here?"
Arthur grinned and pushed his glasses, which he'd found higher on his shiny nose. "My teachers were nuns before this. Can you blame me?"
"A Catholic girl," Arthur said solemnly.
"They didn't get a whole lot of my kind around here."
"Where?"
"Mount St. Teresa Academy?" I waited for his reaction, which I didn't anticipate would be favorable. When his expression remained blank, I added, "In Malvern?" Malvern was technically considered the start of the main line, but it was like the lowest tier of troops, shielding the generals and the captains in the cushy heart of the camp. The plebeians towing its border prickled most storied mainliners. Malvern wasn't really a member of their dynasty. Arthur made a face.
"Malvern? That's far. Is that where you live?"
And so started the years of explaining. "No, I don't actually live there. I live in Chester Springs, which is even farther out, crawling with commoners. And while there are beautiful old houses that would certainly be met with approval, I didn't live in any of them."
"How far away is that?" Arthur asked after I finished my spiel.
"Like half an hour?" It was 45 minutes, 50 some days, but this was another lie I learned to tell. Arthur and I arrived at the entrance to the cafeteria, and he gestured for me to go in first.
"After you."
I didn't know who to be afraid of yet, so even though the cafeteria was packed and brimming with an energy that could have been interpreted as threatening, I was oblivious. I watched Arthur wave to someone and followed him when he said, "Come on." The cafeteria was the confluence where the old mansion and the new school met. The lunch tables were wood, a worn shade of espresso chipped to reveal their sandy skeletons in places. The dark matching floors ended up at a large entryway, which opened up into a newly constructed atrium, with skylights, terrazzo gleaming underfoot, and floor-to-ceiling windows that watched the quad, middle schoolers roaming the grass like cattle. The food was contained in a U-shaped room that welcomed students from the old mansion with a deli bar, and spat you out into the new atrium, shortly past the bony arms of recovering anorexics reaching into the salad bar for broccoli and fat-free Italian dressing. I followed Arthur, who stopped at a table by an antique fireplace. It looked like it hadn't been used for years, but its soot-stained mouth suggested that the former inhabitants had appreciated it. Arthur dumped his book bag into a chair across from a girl with big brown eyes set so far apart they were practically in her sideburns. Kids called her the shark behind her back, but her unusual eyes were actually her best feature, and the thing her husband would eventually love the most about her. She was wearing bulky khakis and a white cotton sweater that gathered underneath her large breasts in a wrinkled pouch. She was flanked by another girl, chin in her hands, her long brown hair spilling over her shoulders and pooling on the table around her elbows. She was so pale, I was shocked by her short skirt, that she would put her white legs on display so brazenly. Mom would have strapped me into a tanning bed before allowing me to go out with skin as blanched as that. It didn't seem to be working against her, though. The guy next to her wore a soccer jersey that seemed mandatory next to his wholesome good looks, and his hand rested on a quadrant of her lower back that only a boyfriend would touch.
"Yo," Arthur said, "this is Tiffany. She went to Catholic school. Be nice to her. She's had it bad enough."
"Hi, Tiffany," the shark said brightly. She dragged a plastic spoon around the curves of an empty pudding cup, trying to scoop up any last remnants of chocolate goo.
"Hi." Arthur pointed at the shark.
"Beth," then the pale girl, "Sarah,
then her boyfriend, Teddy. An acapella of hellos. I held up my hand and said hi again.
Come on.
Arthur tugged my sleeve. I hooked the strap of my book bag over the edge of a chair and approached the line forming at the deli. When it was Arthur's turn, he ordered a whopper of a sandwich, with roast beef and turkey, three different kinds of cheese, no tomatoes, just lettuce, and enough mayo that his lunch made a squishy sound every time he bit into it. I asked for cheese, mustard, and tomato on a spinach wrap. Oh, the days when we thought a wrap had fewer calories than bread. Arthur tossed two bags of chips onto his tray, but I noticed that most of the girls weren't using, so I didn't either. I carried my wrap and my diet Snapple to the register and waited in line to pay.
I like your pants.
The compliment turned me around. A girl who was at once extremely bizarre-looking and attractive nodded at my orange cargo pants, which I already couldn't wait to never wear again. She had strawberry blonde hair that was so uniform in color it couldn't be natural. Large brown eyes, somehow devoid of eyelashes, and skin the color of a girl who had a pool in her backyard and no summer job. In her hot pink button-down and schoolgirl-style plaid skirt that most certainly broke the fingertips rule, she was dressed in a way that defied the androgynous prep style that seemed to be so dominant among Bradley girls. But she carried herself with the air of someone who ran the show.
Thanks, I beamed.
Are you new?
She asked. Her voice was husky, like the voiceovers in those commercials urging you to call 1-900-GIRLS now. Off my nod, she said,
I'm Hillary.
I'm Tiffany.
Yo, Hillary!
The booming voice came from the center of the most esteemed table in the cafeteria, crowded by boys with hair on their legs, real hair, coarse and dark like my father's, and obedient girls to laugh when they accused each other of being any one of the following, pussy, tard, cocksucker.
Yo, Dean, Hillary met his call.
Grab me some Swedish fish, he demanded.
Without a tray, Hillary's hands were full. She tucked her Diet Coke underneath her chin and cradled a bag of pretzels in the crook of her elbow.
I got it.
I was up at the register and grabbed the sack of candy before she did, paying for it along with my wrap and drink over her protests.
I won't forget that, she said,
hooking her pinky around the fish, somehow able to carry all of her purchases with just her hands now. I caught up with Arthur, lingering a few feet away from the cash register. The encounter, Hillary's curiosity about me, had left my face flushed. Sometimes a momentary truce in girlhood is much more precious than a guy you really like asking you out, sticking around even after he got the milk for free.
I see you've met one half of the hoes.
I looked back at Hillary, tossing the bag of Swedish fish onto Dean's lunch tray. Guys could use lunch trays.
Is she slutty?
It's an acronym for Hillary and her best friend, Olivia. That one.
He nodded to the girl with curly brown hair, laughing appreciatively as the hairy legs constructed a fortress out of empty French fry boats. Came up with it for their names.
I don't think they even know what an acronym is.
Arthur sighed, pleased by their ignorance.
Which just makes the whole thing even more brilliant.
I may not have realized that Holden Caulfield was having a mental breakdown at first, but so help me God, I knew what an acronym was.
Are they really hoes?
I'd never heard of a girl willingly co-opting a word like that before. I'd been called a slut once, the natural jump everyone makes when you have adult breasts by the time you're 12. And I wept in Mom's lap for an hour.
They wish they were.
The skin crinkled on the bridge of Arthur's slick nose.
But they wouldn't know what to do with a dick if it punched them in the face.
After lunch, I had chemistry, one of my least favorite subjects, but exciting nonetheless because the hoes were both in my class. That excitement quickly faded when the teacher told us to pair up for an experiment that would prove that chemistry can be cool. I looked desperately to my right, but my neighbor was already twisted in his seat, signaling to someone he wanted to be his partner. It was the same situation on the left.
happy twosomes meandered to the back of the room, and this migration revealed a fellow straggler. A boy with light brown hair and eyes that were visibly blue, even from across the room. He gave me a nod and raised his eyebrows, a silent request to be his partner, even though that was the only option. I nodded back, and we made our way to the stations behind the rows of desks.
"Oh, good," Mrs. Chambers said when she noticed the two of us standing next to each other, still a little unsure.
"Liam and Tiffany, take that last table by the window."
"Like we had any other choice," Liam muttered softly, so Mrs. Chambers wouldn't hear. "Thanks for looking out for the new people."
It took me a second to realize that he was also lumping himself into the new people category. I glanced at him.
"You're new here?"
He shrugged as though he assumed it was obvious.
"I am too," I whispered excitedly. I couldn't believe my luck I'd ended up with him. New people are contractually obligated to look out for each other.
"I know."
He lifted one side of his mouth into a half-smile, and the afternoon light caught a dimple in his cheek. Frozen like that, he could have been a poster you tear out of Tiger Beat.
"You're too pretty to be the last one picked."
I squeezed my thighs together, trying to smother the heat. Mrs. Chambers started in on a lecture about safety that didn't interest anyone until she mentioned that if we weren't careful, we'd walk out of here with our hair and eyebrows singed right off. I looked over my shoulder at her, realizing when I did that Hillary was watching me with her large, lashless eyes, as though she had already suffered the fate that so concerned Mrs. Chambers. I had a split second to make a decision: look away and pretend I hadn't caught her, or smile and have some kind of nonverbal exchange that could further endear me to her. The instinct that had garnered my fleeting popularity at Mount St. Teresa's kicked in, and I chose the latter. To my delight, Hillary smiled back and nudged Olivia, whispering something to her as she leaned in close. Olivia smiled too and signaled to me.
"He's hot," Olivia mouthed, stretching her lips widely around the word "hot," and giving the slightest of nods to Liam.
I quickly glanced at him to make sure he wasn't looking and mouthed back, "I know." My God, was I pleased with myself by the time the bell rang at 3:23 p.m. Only my first day, and I'd established a flirtation with the hot new guy, laid claim to him in a way that only our mutual newness could allow, and I bonded with the hose. I felt like sending a flowery Hallmark card to that beast Sister John. "Dear Sister John, I'm doing so well at my new school, and I found someone who I would like to take my virginity. I only have you to thank." Chapter 3 25, 26, lift your chins. 28, two more, make them your best. 29, 30. I rocked back and rested my butt on my heels, stretching my arms out in front of me in a bid to elongate them after running toward the burn, the prodigal promise that I paid $325 a month to hear. I probably would have that longer, leaner body, too, if only I wasn't so desperate to get food into my mouth by the time I get home that sometimes I don't even take off my coat before I start pillaging the kitchen. "Take your weights back to the bin and set up at the bar for calf raises." This is always the part of class that gives me the most anxiety, because I need to deposit my weights and get to my favorite spot at the bar quickly but politely, when all I want to do is elbow the slow movers out of my way. "I'm going to be on TV and I'm not here for my health, bitches." I settle for the accidental bump, the one I typically reserve for the singers. You know those people, just so fucking happy to be alive, bouncing down the street, buds in their ears and faces repulsive with pleasure as they belt out the lyrics to some noxious Motown classic. I've gotten bold, bumping them with my enormous bag as I pass by, savoring their outraged, "Hey!" behind me. No one gets to be that happy. I'm a little gentler in class. I wouldn't want to alter the image the instructors have of me, one carefully crafted to impress and endear. the sweet but slightly standoffish girl who will always take the most advanced option in the thigh work portion of class, no matter how intensely her legs tremble. Fortunately, by the time I dropped my weights in the bins and turned around, I saw that my favorite spot was wide open. I looped my towel around the bar, placed my water bottle on the ground, and bobbed up and down on the balls of my feet, all the while pulling my stomach back toward my spine and pinching my shoulder blades together. The instructor said, "Nice form, Ani." For an hour, I tucked, sucked in, squeezed, lifted, and pulsed. By final stretch, my limbs felt like the pad thai noodles I'm always craving, and I debated scrapping the 2-mile run back to my apartment. But as I stood to return my mat to the cubbyhole in the front of the room, I caught a glimpse of myself in the front mirror, specifically of the roll bulging over the back of my tank top, and reconsidered. In the locker room after class, some girl who had phoned in all 3 of the abdominal sets said to me, "You were so good." "Sorry?" I had heard her, of course. "During abs? That last position? I tried to let go of my legs, and I couldn't hold myself up for even 1 count." Well, it's the place I need it most, so I push myself as hard as possible. I patted my tummy, swollen against my extra-small Stella McCartney for Adidas yoga pants. Ever since wedding planning began, my binges have returned to their high school-level intensity. For the last few years, I've been able to contain them to Sundays and the occasional Wednesday night. Over-exercising and restricting myself the rest of the week kept my weight steady at 120 pounds. Willowy when you're 5'10", squat when you're 5'3". My goal for the wedding, and most important, the documentary, was 105. And knowing what I was going to have to do, and soon, to attain that, seemed to be exacerbating my cravings as of late. I felt like a deranged bear storing up for anorexia. "No way," the girl insisted. "You look great." "Thanks." My eyes trailed the back of her body as she turned from me to open up her locker. She had a long, narrow torso, offset by wide hips and an expansive, flat ass. I couldn't decide which was worse, going gentle into that mom jeans-wearing night, or fighting it, Botoxed and hungry every step of the way. I slogged home, my feet dragging along the West Side Highway. It took me 25 minutes to run 2 miles, which, even factoring in the stops I had to make to wait at lights so as not to get run over by a car, was pathetic. "Hey, babe." Luke didn't bother to look up from the iPad on his lap. When Luke and I first started dating, my stomach used to latch onto the word babe. Hold it, like those claw games in an arcade would a little stuffed animal. A miracle they came up with anything because everyone knows they're rigged. It was all I ever wanted in high school and college. Some broad-shouldered lacrosse player jogging up behind me and slinging his arm over my shoulder. "Hey, babe. How was your workout?" "Eh." I peeled off my sweaty top, shivered when the wet hair stuck to the nape of my bare neck, no longer barricaded by the Lululemon. I went to the cabinet, located a jar of organic peanut butter, and dipped a spoon into it. "What time are you meeting them again?" I glanced at the clock. 1, I have to get going. I allowed myself a single spoonful of peanut butter and a glass of water before getting into the shower. It took me an hour to get ready, much more than I spend primping for dinner with Luke. There were so many women I was dressing for. The tourists on the street. This is how it's done. The sales girl who would kiss my ass only when she noticed the Miu Miu label nestled in the leather quilts of my bag. Most important today, the 1 bridesmaid, pre-med, who at 23 years old had boldly declared that if she didn't have kids by the time she was 30, she was freezing her eggs. Advanced maternal age is directly correlated with autism. She sucked on her vodka soda so hard it spat a bubble into the air. All these women having kids in their 30s? It's so selfish. If you can't lock it down before then, adopt. Of course, Monica, Moni, Dalton was sure she'd lock it down before she was stuck with a three handle. She hasn't eaten a processed carb since the Sex and the City finale, and her stomach looks like it's been photoshopped. Except, 3 months from now, Moni will be the first of us to turn 29, and there will be no man next to her in bed to rouse her with birthday sex. Her panic smells chemical. Moni also happens to be the most fun to dress for. I love catching her studying the delicate ankle straps of my sandals, the way her eye travels in unison with my emerald. She's no stranger to Barney's herself, but that bill goes to her parents. Not cool once you're on the wrong side of 25. At that point, the only acceptable person to foot your bills is your man or yourself. For the record, I do foot my own shopping bills. Everything but the jewelry. But I'd never be able to do that if not for Luke, if not for him taking care of everything else.
You look nice. Luke planted a kiss on the back of my head on the way to the kitchen.
Thanks. I tugged at the sleeves of my white blazer. I could never roll the cuffs fashion blog right.
You guys are getting brunch after?
Yeah. I stuffed my bag with makeup, sunglasses, New York Magazine, which I'd purposely leave sticking half out of the bag so everyone would know I'm reading New York Magazine, gum, and a rough version of the wedding invitation our timid stationer had drawn up.
Hey, so this week one of my clients really wants us to go out to dinner with him and his wife.
Who? I unrolled the cuffs of my blazer and rolled them up again.
This guy, Andrew, from Goldman.
Maybe Nell knows him, I grinned.
Oh, God. Luke puffed out his cheeks, concerned. I hope not.
Nell makes Luke nervous. I smiled, kissed him on the lips, tasted stale coffee on his breath, tried not to shudder. Tried to remember the first time I saw him. The real first time. At a party when I was a freshman in college, everyone else in seven jeans, me smothered by the waistband of my khakis. Luke was a senior at Hamilton, but his best friend from boarding school went to Wesleyan. They visited each other frequently over the years, but because I was only a freshman, that party fall semester was the first time I'd ever seen him. Luke wanted Nell, then. Before he knew what a ballbuster, his word, she could be. Fortunately or unfortunately, Nell was hooking up with Luke's best friend, so it wasn't happening. When I got home that night, smarting from Luke's perfunctory, hello, I strategized. The guy I wanted Nell. So I watched Nell closely. I ate the way she ate, leaving almost 3/4 of food on the plate. She had a stockpile of blue pills to induce indifference to even the most devastating of carbs. And made Mom buy me the clothes Nell wore when I came home for Thanksgiving break. Nell taught me that I'd been playing it all wrong. Pretty girls had to appear as though they weren't trying to be pretty, which I had made the fatal mistake of doing at Bradley. There were times Nell went out in her father's polo, nasty old Uggs and sweatpants, no makeup, just to prove her loyalty resided with her own gender. Pretty girls also had to have a self-deprecating sense of humor and point out when they had a blistering pimple and talk about their explosive diarrhea to assure other girls that they weren't interested in the role of man-eating minx. Because if the others sensed any level of deliberate prowess, they'd end you, and you could forget about the guy you wanted. The snarling force of a pack of girls could wither the most screaming boner. By the end of freshman year, I could pull those same khakis on and off without ever even unbuttoning them. I still wasn't thin, thin. Wouldn't lose another 10 pounds until after college. But college standards were less rigid than New York ones. Sometime in March, a teasingly warm day, I was walking to class in a trashy tank top. The sun was like a hot hand christening my head as I passed Matt Cody, an ice hockey player who'd humped Nell's thigh so hard his penis had left a red welt on her skin that clung on, ripening in shades of purple and blue and green for nearly a week. He stopped dead in his tracks, marveled at the way the light exploded in my hair and eyes, and actually gasped, "Wow." But I had to be careful.
College was my first go at reinvention, and I couldn't compromise it by getting a reputation again. Nell told me I was the sluttiest tease she ever met. I made out a lot, got topless a lot, but that was as far as I'd go unless the guy was my boyfriend. And I even learned how to make that happen thanks to Nell and what she called her Hemingway theory. Hemingway used to write an ending to his novel only to delete it, asserting that it made the story stronger because the reader would always be able to intuit the ghost of that final incorporeal passage. When you like a guy, Nell reasoned, you need to immediately find another guy. The guy you always catch staring at you in modern American classics, maybe. The one with too much gel in his hair, bad jeans. Smile at him, finally. Let him ask you out. Drink weak whiskey in his dorm room while he waxes poetic about Dave Eggers. Phoenix whining in the background. Dodge his kiss, or don't, and keep doing it until the guy you really like gets a whiff of him. The other guy sniffing around you. He'll smell it on you, his pupils dilating like a shark inhaling a tendril of blood in the water. After I graduated, I came across Luke again, at another party in the city. The timing couldn't have been more serendipitous, because I had a boyfriend, and Christ, that asshole's scent could saturate a football stadium. He was this immensely polarizing descendant of a Mayflower family, who I kept around because he was the only guy who wasn't afraid to do to me what I asked him to do to me in bed. Slap me across the face. Just let me know if this isn't hard enough, he'd whispered, before winding up and backhanding me so hard the nerves in my skull crackled neon, and the dark blurred and twisted, a black blanket ringing above my eyes over and over until I came with a grotesque groan. Luke would have been appalled if I ever asked him to do something like that to me. But I was willing to trade that pulsating need to be savaged, whether a result of nature or one of nurture I could never figure out, for a name like his, one I'd kill to put a missus in front of. When I finally broke up with my boyfriend, for Luke, the sudden freedom allotted us to go out to dinner together and go home together like a real couple was intoxicating, carried us fast and far like a riptide, and we moved in together after a year. Luke knows I went to Wesleyan, obviously, always comments on how funny it is that we never crossed paths all those times he came to visit.
This is the Emil in Rosewater. The salesgirl pulled the dress off the hanger and swung it around in front of her body, holding up the skirt and pinching the material between her thumb and index finger. You can see it has a little bit of a sheen. I glanced at Nell. Nell, still a head-turner, Mom's word, even after all these years. She'll never need to get married to feel good about herself the way the rest of us have to. She used to work in finance, was one of two girls on the floor, the guys swiveling in their seats to catch a glimpse of Banker Barbie as she strode past. At the Christmas party 2 years ago, one of her meathead co-workers, married, with children, of course, picked her up, threw her over his shoulder so that her dress flipped up and exposed her elegant ass, then ran around the room making monkey noises while everyone whooped and hollered. Why monkey noises, I'd asked. I guess that was his impression of Tarzan? Nell's shoulders poked up into her ears. He wasn't the smartest. She sued the company for an undisclosed sum, and now she sleeps until 9 every morning, follows up a spin class with yoga, and snatches the brunch bill off the table before any of us can get to it. One side of Nell's mouth pinched. I'm going to look naked in that color.
We'll have spray tans, Moni reminded her.
The light streaming in from the window pointed at a monstrous pimple on her cheek, smothered in two pink concealer.
She was really stressed over this whole me getting married before her thing.
Midnight is a very flattering shade.
A Cartier love bracelet slid loose from the salesgirl's sleeve as she returned the rose water to the rack and presented its navy cousin with a flourish. She was a natural blonde, probably made blonder by a mere one or two trips to Marie Robinson a year.
Do people ever mix colors? I asked. All the time.
She went in for the clincher.
Georgina Bloomberg was in here the other week for a friend, and that's exactly what they're doing. She pulled a third option, a hideous shade of eggplant, and added, It can be very chic when done right. How many bridesmaids are you having again? There were 7, all from Wesleyan, and all of them living in New York, but the 2 who went the D.C. route. 9 groomsmen for Luke, all of them Hamilton grads, with the exception of his older brother Garrett, who graduated magna cum laude from Duke. All of them in the city, too. I once commented to Luke how sad it was that we both came here so thoroughly insulated with friends that we never really got to experience New York. All the weirdos roaming here, all the wild, mythical nights waiting for us, we didn't need them, so we never sought them out. Luke told me it's amazing how I always find a way to turn a positive into a negative. Nell and Moni went into the back room to show me just how chic Rosewater and Midnight can look together, and I dug around in my purse for my phone. I held it out in front of me at chin height while I scrolled through my Twitter and Instagram feeds. Our beauty director had recently filmed a segment for the Today Show to warn viewers about the real dangers of smartphone addiction, breakouts in the cell phone zone, and early onset turkey neck. From all that looking down to see who had just gotten her butt kicked and her soul cleansed at SoulCycle. Spencer had followed me on Instagram after we met. I didn't recognize any of the people in the filtered haze of her pictures, but I did notice a comment asking if she would be attending the Friends of the Five event, taking place in a sad pub located next to a Starbucks in Villanova, PA. A part of me fantasized about what it would be like to go, to show up in simple cashmere, that emerald cockroach attached to my finger, Luke at my side, emanating so much unabashed confidence that through some sort of osmosis I'd bear it too. The place I had worked so hard to fit into that was now beneath me. All those losers who never left the main line, who lived in apartments that probably had carpeting. God! There would be a whisper through the crowd, half of them outraged, half of them impressed. There, did you see who is here? She's got balls. Meaning a different thing to each of them. Maybe there would be the guy who still believed I owed him a fuck after all these years. The event was months away. If I hit my goal weight by then, maybe. I switched from Instagram to email right as Nell glided out of the dressing room, rose water draped over her picnic bench of a body, the exposed back revealing nothing but skin and spine. Wow, Love Bracelet breathed. And it wasn't just to get the sale. Nell pressed her stubby hands against her chest, flat as the thin-crust pizzas we used to order for breakfast in college. I had to look away. Nell chews on her appendages for sport, and the jagged edges of her fingertips, the raw and bloodied flaps of skin, they remind me too much of how easily the seams of the body fall apart. If a rapist breaks into your apartment, I'd once hypothesized in the middle of a Law and Order episode, how are you going to claw his eyes out with those nubs?
I guess I should get a gun, then.
Halfway through that statement, Nell's blue eyes had lit up with alarm. Too late, neurons had lit a match to the thought and fired the sentence out of her mouth before she could stop it.
Sorry,
she'd added clumsily. Don't be. I'd pointed the controller at the TV and turned up the volume. Sarcasm doesn't have to die for the Five.
Annie, I look like I'm wearing a flesh dress.
It may have been spoken like a complaint, but Nell was admiring the smooth expanse of her back in the mirror, the way the color blended seamlessly into the skin just above her ass, worth an undisclosed sum, so that you couldn't tell where the dress ended and Nell began.
Are you really going to make me stand next to her?
Moni whined, sweeping open the curtain to the dressing room. Moni will never be done trying to make Nell her best friend. She just doesn't get it. Nell doesn't want her ass kissed. She doesn't need it.
That's a great color on you, Moni, I said slyly, when Nell pretended not to hear her.
I'll never be done with rubbing it in Moni's pouty little face that Nell chose me, the Guido, over her, the Darien princess. Moni fussed.
I can't wear a bra, though.
Love Bracelet scurried over to Moni.
saggy boobs would not cost a sale, not on her watch, and began rearranging the jersey strands of the dress.
It's convertible, see? Flattering for all body types.
She ultimately tied what looked like a sling for a uniboob. Moni hoisted the sides of the dress in the mirror, her breasts rippling beneath the fabric like an underwater bomb had gone off thousands of feet below.
You think the other girls will look good in this? Moni pressed.
The rest of the group couldn't make the appointment today, graciously leaving the decision in the hands of Moni and Mel. Luke had three single groomsmen. Garrett, who wore polarized Ray-Bans and put his hand on your back when he spoke to you, was one of them. No one would dare jeopardize her place in the wedding party, her shot at Garrett as her escort, by being combative about the dresses.
I love it,
Nell announced. It was all she had to say, and half-heartedly at that.
It is kind of cool,
Moni agreed, scowling at her body from different angles. I went back to my phone, checking email this time, forgetting all about early-onset turkey neck when I came across a subject line that roiled the lone tablespoon of peanut butter in my neglected belly. Friend of five, schedule update, it read, an urgent red flag waving by its side.
God damn it.
I tapped on the message to open it.
What?
Nell was holding the hemline of the dress above her knee, seeing how it looked short.
I groaned.
They want to move filming to the beginning of September.
What was it before?
The end of September.
So, what's the problem?
Nell's brow would have furrowed if not for Botox.
Preventative, she'd said defensively.
The problem is that I've been eating like a beast. I have to go anno now if I want to be ready by September 4th.
Ani.
Hands on 32-inch hips, Nell said,
stop. You are so tiny right now.
Nell would kill herself if she was ever this tiny.
You should do the Ducan diet, Moni chimed in. My sister did it before her wedding.
She snapped her fingers,
dropped 8 pounds in 3 weeks, and she was already a two. That's the diet Kate Middleton used,
Love Bracelet said, and we all acknowledged the Duchess of Cambridge with a moment of silence. Kate Middleton looked so hungry on her wedding day, it had to be commended.
Let's go to brunch, I sighed.
This conversation was making me wish I was alone in my kitchen, deepest night, with a stocked fridge and hours to myself to defile it. I loved the evenings Luke had clients to entertain. I'd come home with two plastic bags filled with the neighborhood bodega's finest carbs, devour every last starchy crumb, and toss the evidence down the garbage chute, Luke none the wiser. After I fed, I'd watch hours of porn clips, the kind where the men shouted at the women to bark like dogs or they would stop fucking them. I'd come again and again. It didn't take me long. Then I'd collapse into bed, telling myself that I wouldn't want to marry someone who would be willing to do that to me anyway. Moni got up to go to the bathroom after we ordered.
What are you thinking for the dresses?
Nell shook her frosty hair out of a knot. The bartender stared.
You looked great in the rose water, I said. But your nipples are kind of a problem.
What would Mr. and Mrs. Harrison say?
Nell placed her hand over her heart, a scandalized Victorian in a too-tight corset. My future in-laws amuse Nell to no end, what with their misleadingly modest home in Rye, New York, their summer estate on Nantucket, his bow ties, and her chic white bob held away from her face with a velvet headband. I wouldn't have blamed them for turning up their classic Nordic noses at me, but Mrs. Harrison had always wanted a daughter, and I still can't believe that she's satisfied with the likes of me. I don't think Mrs. Harrison has ever seen her own nipples, I said. It would probably be a good anatomy lesson for her. Nell held up an invisible monocle to her left eye and squinted.
So these are what you call areolas, dear?
She said, her voice wobbly as elderly tourists standing on the subway. It was a stereotypical old lady impersonation, and she sounded nothing like Mrs. Harrison. I could picture the look on my future Mills face if she could hear us, roasting her over the cayenne pepper in our $14 Bloody Marys. She wouldn't get mad. Mrs. Harrison never gets mad. Instead, her fine eyebrows would pinch, the skin there collapsing in a way Nell's cannot, her lips parting in a soft, "Oh." She had been so patient the first time Mom visited the Harrison home, prowling the handsomely decorated rooms, turning over candlesticks and other totems to decipher their origins. "Scully and Scully, is that a store in New York?" "Mom, stop." Most important, Mr. and Mrs. Harrison were contributing 60% to the wedding. 30% was coming from Luke and me. Okay, Luke. And the remaining 10% from my parents, despite my protestations that they didn't have to. Despite the fact the check would never clear, even though they insisted. As the main investors, the Harrisons were fully within their rights to veto my fabulously hipster band and dominate the guest list. More 60-year-old women in headbands, fewer 28-year-olds in skanky party dresses. But Mrs. Harrison had only held up her never-manicured hands and told me, "This is your wedding, Ani, and you should plan it as you see fit." When the documentary people first reached out to me, I'd gone to her, fear lodged in some secret pocket in my throat, like I'd swallowed a bulging time-release Adderall with no water. My voice so husky I was embarrassed by it, I'd told her how they were digging into the incident at Bradley, that they wanted to portray the untold story, the real story, the one the media had gotten wrong 14 years ago. It would be worse if I didn't agree to be a part of it, I reasoned. They could paint me any way they wanted. And at least if I had the opportunity to speak for myself, I could. "Ani," she'd stopped me, her expression bewildered. "Of course you need to do it. I think this is a very important thing for you to do." God, I am a shit. Nell acknowledged the shine in my eyes by diverting the conversation. "So, midnight?" I liked the midnight. "Me too." I twisted my napkin into a villainous mustache, the ends, pointy and hard, curled into a wicked smile. "Stop worrying about the new film date," Nell said, her read on me as sharp and as worrisome as Luke's is not. I came across Nell like you would a Robert Mapplethorpe at a street art fair, gobsmacked that something so valuable would be lumped in with a bunch of other crap like that. She'd been slumped against the bathroom wall in Butterfields, a dorm we later took to calling Butterfingers for the lacrosse team residents who manhandled girls made Gumby-legged by Popoff vodka. Even with her mouth hanging open, her tongue dry and pebbled white from all the medically sanctioned stimulants, there was no question that she had a movie star face. "Hey," I said, my hand on her tanning bed tan shoulder. Easy to crawl into those fluorescent coffins when you're so young you think 24 sounds ancient. And I shook her until she opened her eyes, and I saw that, of course, they were as brilliant blue as the sky on the cover of the Wesleyan brochure mailed to prospective students. "My bag," Nell kept wailing, even as I pulled her to her feet, wrapped my arm around her dagger ribs, and dragged her back to my room. I had to throw her into the brush twice, leaping on top of her as Officer Stan from campus security ambled by in a golf cart, out for freshman blood with an alcohol content of 0.001 or more. I woke up the next morning to find Nell scrambling about on my floor, digging under my futon, her frustration sounding in quiet grunts. "I tried to find your bag," I said defensively. She looked up at me, panic freezing her on all fours. "Who are you?" We never found her bag, but eventually I figured out why it was so goddamn important to her. The bottle of pills, to help her sleep, to help her not eat, to help her stay up all night studying in the library, clanking together like a baby's rattle as she walked. It's the only thing we don't really talk about. Nell reached across the table and her ugly fingers pushed into the crevices of mine. She squeezed, and I felt the tiny bug between our hands, hers stained blue when she drew it back. I put the discipline on my tongue, took a gulp of my bloody, swallowed, and waited. Even if this documentary did nothing to clear my old name, even if no one believed me, the least I could do was take away their ammo. She's disgusting, nothing but a fat, bitter slam pig. The pill left a residue on my tongue that tasted the way money smells. Musky. Powdery. And I willed myself to believe that redemption was the only possibility. Chapter 4. It was only my second week at Bradley, and already I had to replace my entire wardrobe, with the exception of the orange cargo pants from Abercrombie and Fitch. Ostentatious as they were, Hillary had graced them with her seal of approval. I had a vision of her in my room, complimenting the mid-level mall collection in my walk-in closet. Nestled between a stack of khakis, she'd spy a flap of orange, sticking out at her like a candy-coated tongue. "Do you want them?" I'd say. "They're yours." "No, seriously, they're yours." Mom took me to the King of Prussia Mall, and we spent $200 at J. Crew on piles of tweedy, cable-knit things. Next, we went to Victoria's Secret, where I picked out a rainbow selection of tank tops with built-in shelf bras. Mom suggested I wear them under everything to smooth out my baby fat, which puckered stubbornly around my belly button. The last stop was Nordstrom, for a pair of Steve Madden clogs, the same ones all the wrap and salad girls wore. You heard them thwacking down the hall before you saw them, the soles of the shoes sticking and unsticking from their heels. "I just want to glue them to their feet," I overheard a teacher say. I begged Mom to round out our purchases with a Tiffany infinity necklace, but she said Dad would have her head. "Maybe for Christmas," she teased. "Get good grades." The other major change involved my hair. Dad's side of the family is 100% Italian, but Mom is sliced with Irish, and with my coloring, Hillary determined I could handle even blonder highlights. She told me the name of the salon she went to, and Mom booked the first available appointment with the cheapest stylist on staff. The place was all the way out in Bala Cynwyd, which was even closer to Philadelphia and, therefore, farther from us. Mom and I got atrociously lost on the way to the appointment, and we arrived 20 minutes late, which Mom said the snotty receptionist didn't have to remind us of 3 fucking times. I was worried the salon would turn me away and tried to reassure myself that we'd been seen climbing out of a BMW. That had to count for something, right? Thankfully, the cheapest stylist on staff found it in her heart to pardon our tardiness and painted my head in thick stripes of yellow, orange, and white, each one at least an inch from my scalp, so that I already needed a touch-up before I even walked out the doors. Mom did not care for the final product, and threw an embarrassing fit, which at least managed to get us 20% off the salon's crappy services. Then we drove straight to the drugstore and purchased a light brown hair dye for $12.49, which, when blended with the expensively bad bleach job, resulted in a gorgeous golden hue that faded into the same color as Mom's exhausted brass candlesticks as quickly as my star rose and fell at school. I found it fitting that my perfect shade of blonde lasted as long as my popularity, really. Even though Hillary and Olivia were warming to me, they were still cautious. So I kept my head down and spoke only when spoken to, usually in passing in the hallways or on the way out of the classroom. I was a while off from being invited to eat lunch with them, further still from being invited to one of their houses on the weekend, and I didn't push my luck. I understood this was the assessment period. I could be patient. In the meantime, Arthur and crew kept me company, and it wasn't bad company by any means. Arthur cherished his gossip, and I don't know how he did it, but he was always the first to report on a mortifying incident he had no business knowing about. He was the one to break the story that Chauncey Gordon, an icy junior with a sneer perpetually tattooed on her face, had been so drunk at a party that when the student president tried to finger her, she peed all over his hand. Teddy had actually been at that party, and even Teddy didn't know that. Teddy had the kind of pebbled red cheeks that all blonde, sporty boys seem to have, and his summer tan came all the way from Madrid, where he'd attended a prestigious tennis camp for promising and rich young athletes. Without a football team, Bradley students chose soccer as the sport to revere, and they didn't care about tennis.